From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A presidential panel has released its report on the CIA in Guatemala, but the American victims are still not satisfied.
I know what it is to be an innocent civilian and to be accused, interrogated, and tortured. I know what it is to have my own government ignore my claims for justice because they cause political problems for a close ally. I know what it is to wait in the dark for torture. And what it is to wait in the dark for truth, I'm still waiting.
It's the eve of the Russian elections, and anti-American sentiment is at an all-time high, and facing the wrath, the role of the Christian right in the 1996 elections. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton flies to Chicago today to address a senior citizens group which has strongly backed him on Medicare. Organizers say some 2,000 activists from the National Council of Senior Citizens will be ready to cheer Clinton with balloons and signs saying, "No more hot air, protect Medicare." Clinton has accused Republicans of seeking to slash Medicare to fund tax cuts. Republicans say savings must be made if the system is to remain solvent. Press Secretary Mike McCurry says Clinton will again urge Congress to bank the savings both sides have already agreed to make and put off any additional cuts until later. It's a call that has fallen on deaf ears before. And a fire started by Molotov cocktails Sunday badly damaged a rural church attended mainly by blacks in eastern North Carolina. Meanwhile, unions are pledging support for churches destroyed by arson. With more than 40 black churches burned throughout the South, labor leaders say they want to help, not just to rebuild, but also to mend racial fences. The Laborers International Union has promised to send workers to help reconstruct a church in Louisiana. The United Auto Workers has pledged $25,000 to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to help rebuild churches. And federal regulators will take a look at a consumer group's claim that Olestra is making people sick. The Center for Science and the Public Interest says there are so many complaints about the no-calorie fat replacement product that the Food and Drug Administration should ban it. The center says 192 people in the Midwest got diarrhea after eating potato chips made with Olestra. And House Speaker Newt Gingrich, whose income was reportedly more than $900,000 last year, has failed to deliver on a pledge he made 15 months ago to donate $2,000 a year to public television. And today's top story, federal authorities have charged 12 members of an Arizona militia yesterday with conspiring to train themselves and others to conduct terrorist assaults on federal and local government buildings in the Phoenix area, including those housing the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Secret Service, and the IRS. You're listening to Democracy Now! A White House report Friday linked the Central Intelligence Agency to serious human rights violations in Guatemala, something human rights activists and Guatemalans have been charging for decades. The board found that Efraim Bamaka Velasquez, a guerrilla leader who was married to Harvard-educated U.S. lawyer Jennifer Harberry, was probably captured in 1992 and killed within a year. Those involved with the killing somehow connected to the Central Intelligence Agency. We'll be speaking with Jennifer Harberry in just a minute, but first we're going to go to another victim of Guatemalan terror, and that is U.S. nun Sister Diana Ortiz. The board made only minimal comment in her case. She was a U.S. nun who alleged that an American known only as Alejandro was present when she was abducted, tortured, and raped while working on a literacy project in Guatemala. Here we turn to Sister Diana Ortiz, who was at a news conference yesterday responding to the report of the Intelligence Oversight Board, known as the IOB, appointed by President Clinton.
With the publication of the IOB report, the U.S. government asserts that a crime was committed against me. I was simply not suffering from a bad case of nerves, as former Defense Minister Hector Gramajo would have it, and I did not stage my own kidnapping for political motives, as former U.S. Ambassador Thomas Strzok has implied. And I was not in some kinky lesbian sexual relationship, as U.S. State Department official Lou Anslem has suggested. The IOB concedes that I suffered horrific abuses. This is progress. Horrific is a very strong adjective, but it does not depict what I experienced. Secret detention, interrogation, gang rape, and torture by members of the Guatemalan security forces, the CIA's partners in a war fought with U.S. funding, but without the knowledge or consent of the American people. The majority of the victims of this war, like myself, have been civilians. The first ordeal of my torture was a game. As my torturers explained, if I answered questions well, I would get to smoke. And if I answered poorly, they would burn me with their cigarettes. When I said the rules of the game were unfair, they burned me. And they asked me well over 100 questions. And no matter how I answered, they burned me. As in Jennifer Harberry's case, in my case, the IOB is playing with words. I have had enough of games. Games where my answers, however truthful, seem futile. From 1990 to 1995, 2,161 civilians were assassinated. And that was done with our tax dollars, with the knowledge of U.S. policymakers. Little of the truth has emerged in my case. I was supposed to have received a number of declassified documents on Saturday. Some error was made. They never arrived. I will give the State Department what it has not given me all these years, the benefit of the doubt, and assume the delay was not intentional. Nonetheless, thanks to the IOB, we at last have in writing what the U.S. government has denied for years. We have been fighting the dirty war in Guatemala. I am one of the victims of that war, and I know what few U.S. citizens know. I know what it is to be an innocent civilian and to be accused, interrogated, and tortured. I know what it is to have my own government ignore my claims for justice because they cause political problems for a close ally. I know what it is to wait in the dark for torture and what it is to wait in the dark for truth. I'm still waiting.
American nun Sister Diana Ortiz, responding yesterday to President Clinton's Intelligence Oversight Board report linking the Central Intelligence Agency to serious human rights violations in Guatemala. In just a minute, we'll be hearing from Jennifer Harberry. But first, we go to Mike McCurry, the White House press spokesperson, who also talked about the report in yesterday's press briefing.
That was a considerable piece of work. It shed a lot of light on events as best as they are known in the 1980s in Guatemala, but it also pointed to some important changes that need to be made, specifically with respect to the relationship between our intelligence community and those who serve as ambassadors or diplomats in individual posts around the world. The White House credits Director of Central Intelligence John Deutsch with doing a fabulous job instituting these and procedures. He has already moved very swiftly to put a lot of these recommended procedures in place, and the President has a great deal of confidence that that type of abuse, given the ethic and direction and management of this CIA and this intelligence community under John Deutsch, he feels very confident the American people can be assured that that type of abuse is not occurring and will not occur.
On the request, I think it's today, for more documents dating back.
Well, I don't it may be that whether it's Sister Ortiz or Jennifer Harbury or others, it'll be hard to satisfy them because some fundamental things that they want to know as human beings may be unknowable based on the record. But the report itself, which goes into exhaustive detail on what was known by representatives of the government and those who were assets of the United States government at the time, presents the most compelling record that we believe can be assembled as to what happened in the 1980s with respect to those two cases and the other cases that were under the purview of the Intelligence Oversight Board's review.
And that was White House press spokesperson Mike McCurry talking about the report released by the White House on Friday, which concluded that Guatemalan military officers suspected of human rights abuses, including murder, worked as paid informers for the Central Intelligence Agency. We're now joined by Jennifer Harbury, who is one of the cases that Mike McCurry talked about. Jennifer, Mike McCurry says perhaps in the case of your husband, the last at the time surviving Mayan guerrilla commandante in Guatemala, killed by the Guatemalan military. Perhaps his case is just going to be unknowable.
Well, I think that's a little naive to say that because I know that when my husband was captured alive by the Guatemalan army, the CIA notified the White House, the State Department, and numerous other U.S. agencies 6 days after his capture in 1992, saying, what an amazing prisoner. He's very important. He probably has a great deal of very important information, and the Army is going to fake his death, most likely, so that they can better take advantage of that information. Then there's a big gap in the records until they say, oh, yes, he was killed a few years ago back, you know, as of 93, they're reporting that he had already been killed. He was, in fact, in the hands of their own assets, their own paid informants who were torturing him. He was severely tortured with drugs at one point, causing his body to swell several times normal size. And we also know that he was placed in a full body cast to prevent him from trying to escape, which he had done already on numerous occasions. For the CIA to think he was such an exciting and important prisoner and then just suddenly stop trying to find out what he was saying, I find completely silly.
Now, you engaged in several long hunger fasts that, in fact, jeopardized not only your health but your life in Guatemala and here in Washington, D.C. At the time, what was the U.S. government telling you when you were demanding information about your husband, his whereabouts, what had happened to him?
As of the time that I first went public with my relationship, because I had found out that he did not die in combat and was, in fact, being held and tortured by the Army, that was March 1993. That's when I first approached the embassy. From then until after 60 Minutes reported that the CIA did, in fact, have information about him, which was late 1994 when I had stopped eating for 32 days on my second hunger strike. In that entire time frame, March 93 to November 94, all I ever heard was, well, Jennifer, we've asked and asked, and we've tried to find out what happened to him, but the Army says they don't have him, so what more can we do? In fact, as I've already said, the CIA notified the White House and the State Department that he was captured alive, not seriously wounded, and was being secretly detained as of the first week of his capture in 1992.
So the U.S. government was covering up all of these years, but now, as of this past Friday, they've come out with the Intelligence Oversight Board report on your case, on Sister Diana Ortiz's case, and a few others. What have you learned? What is new that's come out of this report? And have you gotten more documents?
I have gotten more documents, most of which repeat, you know, a lot of things that I had finally been told before. I did get some more grim information about the sorts of torture that he was submitted to, and most of the reports seemed to coincide in his death as of 1992, something that was not completely clear before. What I'm not at all satisfied, like I say, is the enormous gap between the time that they announce that he's been captured and what an exciting prisoner he is, and then the time that they start reporting his death. They obviously were interested enough that there are many reports about what he was saying and what was happening to him in between. I want the documents in that gap. And, of course, we're pleased with such things as the admission that the CIA was aware that their assets engaged in gross human rights violations.
Explain what you mean when you say their assets.
The CIA pays certain people in the Guatemalan army in return for information. our quarrel, as very well illustrated in my own case or my husband's case, is that they pay for information that they know is being extracted from people who are being seriously tortured, grimly tortured, mutilated, held in secret cells, and then murdered without a trial and tossed into secret cemeteries. We don't think this is a good use of our tax dollars.
Now, CIA Director John Deutsch, who you just heard Mike McCurry expressing great faith in on the part of the president, who says he's going to make changes, noted that the report did not find any complicity by CIA officers or other U.S. government employees in any of the abuses, but he said he took extremely seriously the findings that the agency failed to keep Congress as well informed as it should have, and that it paid insufficient attention to human rights in Guatemala. So it sounds like the only crime, if he would even call it a crime, was what was reported to Congress. Is that what you say?
No. I certainly agree that it was a very serious crime to fail to report accurately to Congress. We've managed to cover up for 200,000 tortures and murders in Guatemala, which is, I think, is a pretty serious distortion. What I don't agree with is that is the only crime. If in this country you aid and assist in a murder robbery, you're in big trouble. If you pay for goods that were taken in a robbery, if you buy stolen goods, you're in big trouble. If you buy stolen goods in a murder case, you're in very good trouble. If you pay for goods that you know are going to be stolen, if you pay for those in advance, you're in huge trouble. And if you know someone's going to be tortured and murdered and pay for the goods in his house in advance, you're in horrible trouble. Now, the CIA has done exactly that in all of these different cases in Guatemala, my husband's case being a classic. They paid for information they knew would be extracted through hideous torture and eventually his murder. Now, why aren't they in trouble for that?
What are you demanding right now?
On behalf, well, all of us in Coalition Missing, on behalf of all of our friends in Guatemala, are demanding that
Explain
all of the files.
Explain what Coalition Missing is.
Coalition Missing is an association of all of those of us U.S. citizens that were either tortured ourselves in Guatemala, as the case of Sister Diana Ortiz, or had a family member murdered in Guatemala. Not street crime, but official repression. There's a young woman whose father worked with street children who was bludgeoned to death, et cetera, et cetera. All of us are asking that all files on Guatemala human rights cases be opened as of 1954. We want all of the files open for all Guatemalans, for all of ourselves. We feel it's very important for the Guatemalan people and very important for us as U.S. citizens to find out what our government did so that we can clean up our own house.
1954 being the time when the U.S. CIA overthrew the democratically elected government
Correct.
Of Guatemala. Now, what chance do you think there is of having all documents declassified? And what do you think those documents would show about U.S. government officials?
I think we got a big battle on our hands that'll last quite a few more years. I think it's very important because I think what those documents will show is that our CIA worked hand in glove with the Guatemalan army. I think we knew very well about all of the tortures, secret prisons, and murders that were ongoing. I think we were involved very directly. I think that in many, many cases, CIA agents were walking in and out of torture cells. I think we knew where they were. I think we knew who was being tortured. I think we never called the Red Cross. I think we never called the UN. I think we lied to Congress about it, and I think we paid for it. And then I think we covered up for it. And I think that's going to be very embarrassing, and that's why it's going to be quite a battle to get those files released.
Your husband, Efraín Bámica Velásquez, where is his body now, do you know?
I believe that his body is buried at a military base called Las Cabañas. It's a small outpost base, very remote, in the middle of a cornfield, located between two of the military bases where he was last seen alive and being tortured. It's well known to be a body dumping grounds. The local villagers estimate 500 to 2,000 people are buried underneath that base. That's the most probable place that he's buried, although there are certainly differing reports.
The situation in Guatemala right now, when we just have a few seconds, could you describe it?
It's deteriorating very seriously. The army's disintegrating, as far as I can see, into a group of mafia-style warlords. They're carrying out drug trafficking. They're attacking cars, driving on the highway, stealing the cars, killing people, carrying out kidnappings, et cetera, et cetera. Human rights violations are way, way up.
Jennifer Harbury, I want to thank you very much for joining us again. Jennifer Harbury responding to the Intelligence Oversight Board report that came out last Friday. And clearly, the story is not over and the information is not all out. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay tuned for a discussion of Russia and then the Christian Coalition here in this country. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now!, the show that covers elections and democracy movements around the world. Tomorrow, Russia will hold a runoff election for the presidency. Incumbent Boris Yeltsin is facing a serious challenge from Communist Party leader Gennady Zyuganov. The Clinton administration has backed Yeltsin through thick and thin, a policy which some are saying is short-sighted and has contributed to a growing anti-American sentiment in Russia. We'll talk with two people in Moscow, Princeton University professor Steve Cohen and Nation magazine editor Katrina Vandenhoevel. In the past few days, many have expressed concerns about Yeltsin's health, but Vandenhoevel says Russian television hasn't discussed the issue.
The media here has really reverted to Soviet-style practices. There was virtually nothing on Yeltsin's health over the weekend. And more important, it is hard to get reliable news because the central media, certainly television, is just pro-Yeltsin in a way that is reminiscent of the Soviet era. And I think people who grew up in that period were very much reminded of Brezhnev and Chernenko and all of those ill health days in looking at Yeltsin and in looking at how the media treated the health issue.
Why is it that the media is so pro-Yeltsin? I mean, I was reading a piece you did recently in The Nation magazine, and you quote someone saying, like in the old days, we have to turn to international media, to international radio broadcasts to find out what's going on in our own country.
There are a number of issues, but it really has, what this campaign has exposed is the degradation of whatever fragile democracy existed, certainly a strong independent press, which did show itself during the coverage of the Chechen War in its early days. Much of the media has been formed by the process of polarization that this campaign has led to, and they fear, many in the central media in Moscow, that if the communists come to power, they will lose their property that goes for the national independent television station, or they will be stripped of their jobs, their dachas, their cars, their right to free speech. But what they've done in the process of this campaign is, in a sense, strip themselves of their reliability, of their honor, their decency as journalists. There was a story in the Washington Post the other day that was quite good, which detailed the fact that the Yeltsin camp has paid for stories, has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars bribing and influencing Russian journalists to spread a pro-Yeltsin message. That has to have a real toll on the press's independence here. If Yeltsin wins, what will the press do? Go back to its ways of criticizing the Yeltsin administration? Even if it does, it has lost its independence.
We're talking to Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's editor of The Nation magazine, is in Moscow right now on the day before the runoff election. Let me ask you about the man that he has thrown his lot in with, and that is, what is he, Admiral General Lebed?
General Lebed.
General Lebed.
An interesting character. Lebed means swan in Russian, but I think anyone who's seen General Lebed in action wouldn't confuse him with a swan. He ran for parliament in 1995 and did very poorly because he was in a coalition of forces, but he is now, as you know, he came in third in the first round, partly because the Yeltsin team did give him money for airtime and worked with his people, but partly because he has a message that goes over very well in this country, which is, let's take on corruption. We need law and order. His economic program is much more diffuse. He has expressed admiration, if one can believe this, for Augusto Pinochet, the Chilean military leader, and he has now said that he admires de Gaulle more, but he is an unknown quantity. He's playing both sides in this election. It's also unclear if his votes will go to Yeltsin, because many of the people who voted for Lebed voted because he opposed Yeltsin's policies in many areas. So he's an unknown quantity, but I think he is now trying to become vice president, which is an arduous constitutional process, but today Lebed announced that he would like to be vice president because I think he's aware that though he has been said to be the second most powerful man in much of the Western press coverage, in fact, Lebed has no independent party base, no structure. So he really is Yeltsin's creature at this point, unless he can find a real structural position in Yeltsin government.
He got some attention in this country over the weekend because a group of angry U.S. senators called on General Lebed to apologize for calling the Mormon faith mold and filth. Among the leading senators, of course, are Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah, who is Mormon himself. I think the whole quote, "All these Mormons are mold and filth, which have come to destroy the state. The state should outlaw them," and had some pretty unflattering things to say about Jews as well. What is his position?
Well, that position about taking on the missionaries who've come to this country, I put apart the reference to the Jewish religion at this stage, but that is a strong nationalist view in this country, that American missionaries have come here and replaced, quote, traditional Russian religions. On the other hand, in terms of this election campaign, what Lebed is doing, I think, is doing some of Yeltsin's dirty work. He is appealing to the nationalist forces, which the Lebed team wants to co-opt in order to win on Wednesday, and Lebed is the mouthpiece for that. Though on some level it is deeply rooted in his campaign, in Lebed's campaign, and in his thinking. This man is not, he's not apple pie and what I think some in the West at first thought. He's not Dick Tracy. This guy has said some very tough things about the West and its policies in Russia, and much of that was discounted in the early days a few weeks ago because he was thought to represent a free market ideology, which on some level I think is what American policy is looking for in this country. Democracy on some level is secondary, and a free market and a stable economic environment is very important.
Speaking about the United States, what has the U.S. role been in these elections?
You know, we don't know the full story. There have been advisors, but I think more important is that the IMF has played a very important role in suspending its usually very strict guidelines to allow Yeltsin to use IMF money as a campaign chest. Yeltsin has gone around this country giving out money to people who haven't been paid in months and months, workers who haven't been paid, and pensioners who haven't received their pensions. On some level, and I've been very critical of Boris Yeltsin, he may blaze a new set of guidelines for the IMF. Let IMF money be used to pay for social safety net needs. But the IMF in many countries, as you know, would go ballistic if a leader or a government used money in that way. So I would suggest that the U.S. role was very important in saying and dictating to the IMF a relaxation of those strictures. In addition, the U.S. government, on a smaller level, Ambassador Pickering, the U.S. ambassador here, we were told by a presidential candidate who finished fifth, Grigory Yavlinsky, the young economist, had a meeting with him, Yavlinsky, to ask him to drop out in order to favor Boris Yeltsin's chances. I think that's meddling quite deeply in another country's politics.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Katrina Vandenhoevel is the editor of The Nation magazine. We're joined by Stephen Cohen, who's professor of politics and Russian studies at Princeton University in Moscow, too. You did an interesting piece in the recent Nation magazine, It Can't Happen Here. Why don't you lay this out for us? It's certainly a different perspective than we're getting from most of the press in this country about who President Boris Yeltsin is.
Well, the premise of my article was simply to attribute everything that Yeltsin has done in post-Soviet Russia to a communist president and ask if the United States under Clinton would so fulsomely have supported that president. This includes depriving maybe 60 to 70% of the population of their life savings and social welfare benefits, attacking an elected parliament with tanks, waging a bloody war in his own country that's killed 30 or 40,000 people, and running an utterly corrupt presidential campaign. And I said if it wasn't President Boris Yeltsin professing democratic and Western values, but a communist-elected president, would the United States support this president? It was a rhetorical question, but it was meant to illustrate that American support for Yeltsin has been so critical, so fulsome, and our role here is so deep and pervasive that we need to stop and think just exactly what and who it is we've been supporting all these years.
What is the U.S. interest in Russia? Why would the U.S. be supporting Yeltsin?
Well, you're asking me a question that's not clear. Are you asking me what I think American interest is, or are you asking me a question of what do I think Clinton thinks the interest?
Both.
There is. Well, it seems to me that the Clinton administration has wagered everything on Boris Yeltsin. Wagered everything. And the reason would seem to be primarily ideological. That is, Yeltsin has professed to be building some kind of market system. Though interestingly enough, and I don't know how closely Clinton and his Russian experts read what Yeltsin said, Yeltsin has said we are not building capitalism. He says we're also not building socialism. And since America says there is no third way, it's not clear what they think they're supporting. But essentially, Russia has become open to Western capital, that's for sure. And the Russians have, at least during the first two or three years after the fall of the Soviet Union, been semi-cooperative with the United States in world affairs, though they're less so now. And I think that was enough for the Clinton administration. I think also the Clinton administration was terribly afraid of what the alternative to Yeltsin might be, that they might be faced with the charge that they had lost Russia. That doesn't seem to me to be a particularly helpful guide to American foreign policy. I think the United States needs to decide what it wants in Russia. Does it want a truly democratic Russia? Or does it want, given all of Russia's geopolitical vastness and nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors and nuclear knowledge and components, or does it want a stable Russia? Whatever it is the United States wants, it hasn't got either. Russia's neither reliably democratic, and certainly it's not stable. So I would consider the Clinton administration policy toward Russia to have been exceedingly unsuccessful, and it's a rooster that will come home to roost because the backlash against the very intrusive interventionist role of the United States in internal Russian politics is growing every day. I haven't seen so much anti-Americanism in Russia. I don't even think there was this much here during the height of the Cold War. Many pro-Western Russian liberals are aghast at the pervasiveness of the American role and the Clinton administration's utterly uncritical support for Yeltsin.
Professor Cohen, in what way does this anti-American feeling manifest itself?
I think it manifests itself in newspaper articles. It manifests itself in public and private conversations. But more importantly, it manifests itself in a kind of cultural backlash. That is to say that almost everybody in Russia today, including the people we call liberals, almost everybody has become a nationalist. A nationalist in a way that's beyond the normal patriotism that we trot out at every presidential election, where Dole has to be more patriotic than Clinton, and Clinton just as patriotic as Dole and all that. But that here, nationalism is really a word that means more than just patriotism. It means a concept of Russia that is mighty and somewhat apart from the West, depending on the degree of nationalism. And there was a time here, 1991, 92, about mid-1993, where the liberal wing of the Russian political spectrum was anti-nationalist. Publicly, they called themselves anti-nationalists. Now they would never do that. They claim that their nationalism is the authentic nationalism, as opposed to the communist or the patriotic nationalism. But this nationalistic backlash is in part a reaction to what many people fear to be a kind of Americanization of Russian public life. I mean, American and also other Western broadcasts are all over the television and the movie theater. And you have to remember that in a city like Moscow, somewhere between 70% and 80% of everything that's consumed here, from the food stores to the cinema, was not made here, was not produced here. In fact, Russia isn't producing much of anything these days except subsistence agriculture and energy export.
Let me ask you something. One of the things you wrote in your piece is that even if Boris Yeltsin loses, in fact, he may not step down.
Well, what I wanted American readers to understand is that there is a view here, whether it's a realistic view or not, but it's a powerful view here, that Yeltsin would never leave power voluntarily. And if you ask Russians why they think that, you get two kinds of answers. One is, well, no Russian leader has ever left power voluntarily. Therefore, it can't happen here. And that may be nothing more than the fact that, like anyone, Russian people find it hard to believe something that's never happened will actually happen. But nonetheless, that is a mighty precedent. It's never happened. The second reason is that there is a large segment of the Russian population. I can't tell you the actual size of it, but it might be 15 to 25% of the electorate or the population that views Yeltsin's so-called reform since 1991 as what is called here, and I quote, a criminal revolution. And that criminality, the indictment of it, would include the illegal breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, the shock therapy economic policies that were imposed on the country in 92 and deprived almost everybody of life savings, the use of tanks against the elected parliament, privatization, so-called, which turned over the country's richest assets to a small segment of the former nomenklatura, and the war in Chechnya. And in this view, if Yeltsin is actually guilty of these criminal acts, then he would never dare leave power and subject himself to any kind of legal or extra-legal accountability. Now, I don't want to attribute that to Yeltsin personally. I think Yeltsin himself, if he were to lose the election, would have to face a decision. Not to give up power would be not to enter history. To enter history, he has to be the first Russian ruler who was not only elected, but who also left voluntarily if he's defeated. He would have to make that decision. But it is a fact that a large segment of the people who have benefited from his policies have publicly stated that the Yeltsin administration should never leave power voluntarily. And in fact, his former foreign minister, Boris Fyodorov, who is the sort of pet of Western financial circles, said to me in a television program that he and I did together in Canada about a week ago, better a civil war than the communists back in power. So, excuse me, he was the finance minister, not the foreign minister. So there is a powerful opinion in the business community here that the Yeltsin regime dare not, should not, must not, will not leave power. Whether that's so, I don't know. And we may never find out, because we would only know if, in fact, an honest election produced the defeat of Yeltsin.
Given everything else that the U.S. has supported under Yeltsin, what do you think they would do in the case of him not stepping down?
I don't know. I mean, I think that the American presidential election itself has become a factor in what they decide to do. Clinton would have to decide, if he cast moral judgment aside or democratic value aside, if he was cunning, he would have to decide if he was better off at home in the United States in an electoral year, with Yeltsin still in power and not the communists in power, but through an abrogation of democracy, or whether he was better off insisting on the democratic outcome and letting the communists come to power. If he did the latter, Dole will surely say, though it isn't true, but he'll say it anyway, we Republicans, Reagan and Bush, got rid of the Russian communists and Clinton let them back in. It's a preposterous statement on both ends, but it's the sort of thing that is said, and sometimes it's effective in American presidential elections.
Can you tell us why the communists are so popular?
Well, to say that there are several reasons the Communist Party is so popular in Russia today, indeed the largest single political force in the country, and still more, the only real fully nationally organized political party. To say that there are more reasons behind this is immediately break with the prevailing American interpretation that the party's social base is essentially only a bunch of old people who haven't been able to hack market reforms. Even that interpretation, in addition to being a cruel interpretation, I mean, why do you think it's okay to be mean to old people? And in the United States, Dole and Clinton are fighting for the vote of the Medicare generation and the Social Security generation, so we take these people seriously in the United States. But you have to remember that in Russia, when people say the old generation, they often mean people 45 and over, because retirement is somewhat earlier here. So it's really also the upper part of the middle-aged generation. These would be people who had lost a profession due to the market reforms but don't have enough time left to acquire another profession, therefore angry. So, first of all, there's a larger age demographical base of communist support here. that has been generated by the exceedingly unwise and exceedingly painful form of market reform that the Yeltsin administration undertook with the support of the Western community. It's worth saying that Yeltsin's probably created more communists in this country than Lenin was able to do. Lenin's party got about 25% of the vote in the only free national elections just after the revolution. And Zhuganov's Communist Party is doing at least that, and is getting about a third of the nation. So, it's a reaction to Yeltsin's very cruel and harsh economic policies, but there's more. In the parliamentary elections, the communists were able to take a significant portion of the nationalist vote, which shows us that in the minds of many people who are nationalist-minded, the communists are the best vehicle for some sort of revival and resurgence of Russia at home and abroad. And that cuts across age groups. And in addition, if Yeltsin stays on this economic course, the victims of the economic transformation and the pain of it is likely to grow, not decrease, unless you believe the myth that Russia is on the verge of a great economic takeoff, which is just a myth. And that therefore, with more parliamentary elections ahead, possibly within months, it would be foolish to say that this is the Communist Party's last chance. I don't think that's the view of the party leadership, and I don't think it's the view of somebody who really knows Russia today. That party is going to be on the Russian political scene for a long time to come, and it may in some ways be a stronger party, even if it loses elections, by the end of 1996, particularly if there's a financial or economic crisis, as it now seems likely, in the fall.
Princeton University Professor Stephen Cohen speaking to us from Moscow. The Russian runoff election is tomorrow. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. The issue of abortion is dividing the Republican Party in this election year. Yesterday, Bob Dole told NBC that his vice president wouldn't necessarily have to support an all-out ban on abortion. Of course, this might just be a way to make pro-choice Republicans feel better after Dole chooses an anti-choice running mate. But his statements certainly distressed Christian Coalition Executive Director Ralph Reed and Gary Bauer of the Conservative Family Research Council, who are both pressing Dole to pick an anti-abortion running mate. The issue of abortion is also dominating state Republican Party debates. Last month at the Texas Republican Party convention in San Antonio, the Christian right faction tried to block delegates who don't support a constitutional amendment banning abortion from representing the state of Texas at the Republican National Convention in San Diego in August. In large part, they succeeded, although Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson did become a delegate. The Texas convention was the latest manifestation of the Christian right's growing control of the grassroots Republican Party nationwide. Christian Coalition and other Christian conservatives now control the GOP in at least 18 states. Sociologist and author Sarah Diamond has been studying and writing about the Christian right since the early 1980s. Her two most recent books, published this year, are Roads to Dominion, Right-Wing Movements and Political Power in the United States, published by Guilford Press, and a collection of her journalistic writings, Facing the Wrath, Confronting the Right in Dangerous Times, published by Common Courage Press. She spoke recently with Pacifica's national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky about the current status of the Christian right and its influence on this year's elections.
Sarah Diamond, as you've studied the Christian right over the years, how would you assess its present condition and position? Is it growing? Is it stabilized? Is it declining? Can you give that kind of assessment?
I can try to give that kind of assessment. It's not growing, and it has stabilized. And one of the things that, happens in the lifespan of a social movement is that it goes through many phases. And so what's happening right now is because this social movement, the Christian right, has become such an important player in electoral politics, it's now facing a number of quandaries having to do with its own power. So there's a real kind of rumbling going on right now inside the Christian right presently around the whole question of should they become subordinate to the Republican Party, and some people kind of want to go in that direction, and probably a greater number of the actual rank and file of the movement do not. And so an election year like the one we're in now really provokes that question, and especially with the issue of abortion really raises that those sorts of questions for the average activist and for the leadership.
How does that debate get played out inside the Christian right? They don't have an enormous national assembly where there's hundreds of thousands of people who raise their hands and say, yes, I believe we should do such and such, no, I don't. What's the dynamic by which the Christian right, which is, as you always write, a very diverse group, makes that kind of decision as to what position they should take?
Well, the mainstream press typically covers the public statements of key leaders. So recently we've seen quotations in the newspapers from Ralph Reed, from James Dobbs, and from Gary Bauer. But a lot of the way that this debate goes on really is over talk radio. And so, for example, on a program such as Randall Terry Live, Randall Terry, of course, opposes the Republican Party and wants people to vote for Pat Buchanan either as a write-in candidate or with the U.S. Taxpayers Party, and encourages that. One will hear frequently on his call-in show people arguing pro and con, different kinds of positions. So a lot of the ways that people in this movement actually talk to each other is through talk radio.
And what do you hear on talk radio these days vis-a-vis this current election? I know a lot of it, as you prophesied, really, in your book Roads to Dominion, centers around the abortion question and what position they're going to take on that. What do you hear on right-wing talk radio these days?
Well, some people are saying, look, Clinton is so evil that he has to be defeated. Whatever it takes, anything but Clinton is sort of the line there. And there are many other people in the Christian right who are looking more long term and who are basing their views more on what they would consider their principles and are saying that Bob Dole is so much part of the establishment, so much not pro-life because he voted for, Supreme Court justices who were pro-choice because he has voted for funding for Planned Parenthood. Therefore, to vote for him is to sell out to the Republican Party. And so that's really the key debate that's going on right at the present moment.
Is there a sense that the Christian right will be as active this year as they were in 1994 in local districts and in places where they did make a difference then in backing Republican congressional candidates?
Well, I think it's precisely because the quandary over the presidential campaign is so fierce that a lot of people are saying is, look, I'm not really going to pay that much attention to the top of the ticket. I'm mostly going to concentrate on getting people elected to the local level. And that's very convenient when you've got a fight going on at the top level to have people still able to be active at the local level. Yet that's part of the process that the press has a difficult time covering because it's so localized. How do you cover every single little tiny school board race that's going on around the country? So it's very hard to assess the influence there.
Can you give us a quantitative analysis of how many Christian right people you think have been elected in the United States to local offices, school boards, city councils, etc., approximately?
I couldn't possibly give you numbers because one of the things that goes on is groups such as Citizens for Excellence in Education, which focuses on school boards, issues these wild claims that they have thousands upon thousands of people, that they control most of the school boards in the United States, and those figures are not at all reliable. The other issue in this is that in the past few years, one of the things that groups such as the Christian Coalition have focused on is not just getting Christians elected, but making themselves indispensable even to moderate Republicans. So they don't necessarily care even about getting just their own people elected. They just want to make sure that they're the determining factor in whoever does get elected.
Speaking of that, we just had an election in Virginia, which after all should be one of the strongest places of the Christian coalition. It's Pat Robertson's headquarters state. It's where Jerry Falwell is located. Mm-hmm. It's where Ralph Reed is headquartered. And there, the candidate of the Christian right in the Republican primary for Senate James Miller, endorsed heavily by Oliver North at the last minute, lost by a 2-1 margin to incumbent Senator John Warner. Is this an indication the Christian Coalition doesn't really have that much power to decide races anymore?
Well, they may in certain places, and I think each of these cases has its own set of idiosyncrasies. And in Virginia, the Christian right has become so sort of high profile that it may be that it's turning off a lot of voters. Not everybody who lives in Virginia, despite the leadership of the Christian right being there, and even a lot of evangelical Christians are turned off by the Robertsons and the Falwells and the Reeds. So I think it's more complicated, and it may be a place where a more moderate Republican can do well. I mean, we saw that a couple of years ago when Michael Ferris was defeated. He had a lot of backing. He was a first-time candidate, hardcore Christian right leader, and yet he failed. Yet the sort of success that he had was bringing in a lot of Christian right activists into the party, where they've continued to sort of create conflict with the moderates and vice versa.
And he has remained the head of the homeschooling movement nationwide. Why don't you talk for a second about the homeschooling movement as one of the grassroots efforts that the Christian right is running? What are they trying to do, and are they succeeding?
Well, homeschooling is a perfect example of what I call the sort of cultural projects that underlie this political movement. That the movement is not successful politically just because it gets people to the polls. It's because it's part of a whole multifaceted subculture that absorbs people's daily lives. And homeschooling involves, at this point, it's estimated by the Department of Education, about 500,000 to 1 million kids. Who are homeschooled. Some are part-time schooled in private schools, so that's why the figures are variable. But certainly not everybody in the homeschooling movement is a hardcore right-wing activist. However, the leadership of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, Michael Ferris, certainly is. And he frequently uses his network of homeschool organizations state by state to get people to lobby for things such as the Parental Rights Act, such as various bills around, you know, government funding of public education even. So it is sort of a base upon which the Christian right relies whenever there's an issue surrounding education that comes to the fore.
You frequently write about the fact that right-wing Christians are frequently seen as radicals in the society, but that they're not really radical. What do you mean there? What are you trying to say about them?
Well, I'm trying to say a lot of things. One of the things that's happened, unfortunately, in the last few years is a number of centrist organizations have tried to characterize the Christian right as radicals. And what they're really after is anything that is radical. They don't like radicals of the left. In this case, their enemies are radicals, as they say, of the right. There's nothing radical about people such as Ralph Reed, who lobbied for the contract with America, lobbied heavily against health care reform legislation, want to keep the status quo, whether we're talking about inequality of a class, race, or gender nature. It's not radical to support those kinds of inequalities. And just because somebody is sort of kooky or has a loud voice, which many of the people in the Christian right do, does not make them radical. And so I'm interested in letting people know that, in fact, the Christian right is really part and parcel of mainstream politics. And just because you think somebody's a little bit of an oddball, you know, on a personal or aesthetic level, that doesn't make them a radical. To be radical means to want to work for profound social change of a true and lasting nature. And I don't see anything coming from the right that fits that description. That's what the left is all about. And so radical right is really an oxymoron, and it's a very dishonest term that is promoted primarily by people who want to support the Clintons, you know, essentially want to back one aspect of the status quo. And so I think it does a real disservice to progressive people understanding how our system really works to somehow suggest that, you know, people like Pat Robertson or Ralph Reed are doing well because they're not playing by the rules. They're using regular, you know, tried and true tactics of electoral organizing. Frequently they do engage in some sleazy tactics, but by and large they're using the very same process that we've all been taught to be, you know, be participating in. So there's nothing even radical about most of their tactics, actually, either.
Have they been smart enough to pull Pat Robertson out of the spotlight? You really don't hear mm-hmm. much about him. You don't see him quoted anywhere except, of course, on his own extensive media network. But I mean, he's not in the Rolodexes of the Washington establishment press anymore. He doesn't issue press statements and press conferences. Is this because the kookiness of some of the things he said in the past really tended to discredit his movement?
It's partly because after the Pat Robertson presidential campaign of 88, in which he said all kinds of really bizarre things, I've recently been reviewing that whole episode, Ralph Reed doesn't say those kind of things. There's not a whole file folder of kooky things that Ralph Reed has said over the years. The other aspect, however, is that Pat Robertson is very involved in all sorts of things. He's involved in financial dealings with that TV network. He's got the law firm. He's had a huge controversy in the law school, where there was a whole to-do over some professors who were fired in the last few years. So there's a lot that appears in the Christian press about Pat Robertson, doesn't appear in the New York Times. The other thing is Pat has now become a novelist, and he produced his first novel this past year.
Some would say he's been writing fiction all along.
And so he's been very, very prevalent in the Christian press with that. So it's not the case that he's just, you know, off, you know, on a ranch somewhere. He's getting older, and he has said that he's now an elder statesman who's trying to supervise about half a dozen different organizations at the same time. So he can't be out there all the time, and he does have the tendency to stick his foot in his mouth. And so Ralph Reed is a much better sort of face to present and is actually running the Christian Coalition.
One of your two recent books is subtitled Confronting the Right in Dangerous Times. What do you think is necessary to effectively confront the right?
Well, I use the word confront in a sense it refers back to facing, to sort of like look at it, see it, come to grips with it. I don't have solutions. I don't say, look, if we do X, Y, and Z, then the Christian right will go away. I cannot honestly say that. Nor do I think that the left ought to simply be reflecting or reacting to. I think it's very dangerous if the left were to construct a strategy that only responds to the right. I think that instead what one has to do is sort of have a progressive forward-looking agenda, always sort of looking behind to see, well, where is the right in this? What's the opposition going to look like if we proceed on issue whatever? And so the word confront doesn't really mean, you know, like enter into armed combat or anything. It means sort of face and kind of like acknowledge and recognize that this is a permanent fixture in our political world, really.
Finally, Sarah Diamond, the Republicans really seem to have a major problem, as I say again, you've written about in your books, around the question of reproductive choice. And we may come down to the San Diego Republican Convention in August, where the Republicans really can't find common ground on this and will fight with each other right down there on the convention floor. Do you think that there's sufficient support inside the Christian right for a third-party effort from hardliners who really can't abide any compromise on this issue?
Well, this is the debate that's raging right now, and I think that the history of right-wing third parties in this country has been one of failure, and I think a lot of people in the Christian right know that history, too. So there are people who, they're actually, in a way, it's more powerful for them to be able to continually make the threat of leaving and starting a third party. If they were to actually do that, I think that they would lose a tremendous amount of momentum. They wouldn't have members of Congress that they could just go knock on doors and get favors done for them. So it would really be a tremendous loss of power for the Christian right to actually go start a third party. And I think that's precisely why even Patrick Buchanan has been really reluctant to say, yes, I will go join up with the U.S. Taxpayers Party. He doesn't seem at this point to really want to go do that.
Sarah Diamond, scholar and author, most recently of Facing the Wrath, Confronting the Right in Dangerous Times, published by Common Courage Press, and Roads to Dominion, Right-Wing Movements and Political Power in the United States, published by Guilford. Thank you for joining us on Democracy Now!
Thank you.
And thank you for that, Larry. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Kenneth Mason is our engineer. You can call our comment line at 202-588-0988, extension 313. You can get a copy of the show by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!